Justice Alito, in a speech last September at Notre Dame Law School, suggested that the catchy and sinister term shadow docket has been used to portray the court as having been captured by a dangerous cabal that resorts to sneaky and improper methods to get its ways. This portrayal, he says, feeds unprecedented efforts to intimidate the court or damage it as an independent institution. Yes, the term is the problem. How could those words, the words are bad. Okay. Whatever you think of these sort of rhetorical quips, obviously the shadow docket has become a matter that is dividing the justices, even publicly. So my goal in the, 19 minutes that we have left in our conference is to briefly tell you what this is, why I actually think it's problematic, and perhaps, if we have time, what we might do about it. So what is the shadow docket? At least as a reference to the Supreme Court of the United States, right? It's basically a reference to everything other than the merits docket. It's not meant to be a pejorative term. It wasn't coined as a pejorative term. Will Bode, when he coined it in 2015, meant it to capture the obscurity of the fact that when the Supreme Court hands down unsigned, unexplained orders, most people other than the folks in this room have no idea what those orders mean. You guys are like, well, I don't really either, so I'm with them, right? It was about obscurity. Now, historically, right, this includes things like denials of certiorari, right? It includes summary cert stage rulings, so when the Supreme Court summarily reverses at the cert stage without actually conducting plenary review. Even things like motions to expedite the consideration of cert petitions, right? These are just sort of procedural orders that sometimes have substantive effects, right? Other miscellaneous but sometimes significant orders in the SB8 case, right? The fight over whether the remand should go back to the Fifth Circuit or the district court. These are the kinds of things that actually are a significant part of what the U.S. Supreme Court does, but that we don't really pay a lot of substantive academic attention to. All right, how's it changed? So one of the things that people who sort of defend the court's behavior say is this is nothing new. The court's always had a shadow docket. True, right? The very first order, this is a good trivia question. Go home tonight, ask your friends, what was the very first order the U.S. Supreme Court ever issued? Anyone know? I was going to be really surprised. The very first order ever logged in the Supreme Court's journal is an order on February 2nd, 1790, recognizing that the court lacked a quorum and so couldn't meet. Right? It was an order that it could not actually issue an order, so it's kind of a trick question. All right. But although we've always had a shadow docket, in the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen a real uptick in how often the court is using the shadow docket, and especially in emergency applications, to produce substantive results. So some of these are stays of district court rulings, especially of injunctions. We saw one just last month, right, where the Supreme Court stayed an injunction from a Texas judge that would have required the Navy to deploy 26 Navy SEALs who refused to comply with the Navy's vaccination requirement. Right, vacatures of lower court stays. Right, we saw this just a couple weeks ago in the HB 20 case from Texas. Texas, really, you know, we are a jobs program for the shadow docket. Right, stays of circuit court mandates pending certiorari. There's about to be an application for this in the Florida social media case. Stays of execution, right, in the death penalty case or removal in the immigration context. Writs of injunction directly against government officers when the lower courts have not issued injunctions and a party is seeking an emergency injunction pending appeal, right, and then vacatures. We have seen more of these, right, than at any prior point in the court's history. Now, by tradition, when the court rules on these kinds of applications, it doesn't say anything, right? Here's a pretty typical order where there's no substantive explanation, even when, as here, there are multiple justices dissenting, right? And part of why historically that was the case is because these orders were typically anodyne, right? That no one was really troubled by the fact that the Supreme Court did not write an opinion to explain why a party was receiving 4,000 extra words to file a brief, right? Even where there was more activity, in this context, in the death penalty context in the 1980s, right? It wasn't that typical or that problematic that the Supreme Court wasn't writing an opinion every single time a death row inmate sought a stay of execution, right? But, right, this also means that there's a tradition of stealth votes. Unlike the signed opinions of the court we get at the end of the term, where we always know the vote counts, usually one of the top lines, the court voted 6-3. We actually almost never know the vote. When you get a shadow docket ruling, right, here's one of my favorite examples. This is a 20, you probably can't read this, so you'll have to take my word for it. But here is a 2016 order in which Chief Justice Roberts explains why he's providing a fifth vote for a stay from which only two justices publicly dissented. I'm not good at math, but someone's missing, right? This is why one of my bugaboos is when you hear the, in January when the court rejected former President Trump's effort to block the turning over of records to the January 6th committee, everyone said it was an 8-1 ruling. And I'm like, you're wrong, right? Justice Thomas publicly dissented. We have no idea who else. These are the things I care about, right? You guys are like, wow. Of course, if we're all appellate lawyers, we're probably nerdy too. Okay, right, what this means is it's hard to always know not just what the court is doing and why it's doing it, but who is doing it. And yet, even as these have been the historical norms, we've seen far more grants of emergency relief since the mid-2020s. We've seen far more grants with statewide or nationwide consequences. Just one example, right? When the Supreme Court in January blocked on an emergency basis OSHA's vaccination or testing rule for large employers, that affected 83 million people. That's a rather larger ruling than a single death penalty case, right? Far more public dissent.